with his bare hands. Instead, he pretended to be cool, detached. Harsh words would not help Dante. They left the conference room and walked into Robbie's office. Aaron and Fred Pryor stayed outside, ready for whatever came next. Robbie directed Keith and Boyette to a small table in the corner, and all three sat down. "Would you like some coffee or something to drink?" he asked, almost pleasantly. He stared at Boyette, who stared back, without flinching or blinking. Keith cleared his throat and said, "Look, Robbie, I hate to ask for favors, but we haven't eaten in a long time. We're starving." Robbie picked up the phone, rang Carlos, and ordered a tray of deli sandwiches and water. "No sense beating around the bush, Mr. Boyette. Let's hear what you have to say." The tick. The pause. Boyette shifted and squirmed, suddenly unable to make eye contact. "Well, the first thing I want to know is if there's any reward money on the table." Keith dropped his head and said, "Oh, my God." "You're not serious, are you?" Robbie asked. "I suppose everything is serious right now, Mr. Flack," Boyette said. "Wouldn't you agree?" "This is the first mention of reward money," Keith said, completely exasperated. "I have needs," Boyette said. "I don't have a dime and no prospects of finding one. Just curious, that's all." "That's all?" Robbie repeated. "The execution is less than 6 hours away, and our chances of stopping it are very slim. Texas is about to execute an innocent man, and I'm sitting here with the real killer who suddenly wants to get paid for what he's done?"
"Who says I'm the real killer?"
"You," Keith blurted. "You told me you killed her, and you know where the body is buried because you buried it. Stop playing games, Travis."
"If I recall correctly, her father put up a bunch of dough when they were trying to find her. Something like $200,000. That right, Mr. Flack?"
"That was 9 years ago. If you think you're in line for the reward money, you're badly mistaken." Robbie's words were measured, but an explosion was imminent. "Why do you want money?" Keith asked. "According to your own words, you'll be dead in a few months. The tumor, remember?"
"Thanks for reminding me, Pastor."
Robbie glared at Boyette with unrestrained hatred. The truth was that Robbie, at that moment, would sign over every asset he could find in exchange for a nice thick affidavit that told the truth and might save his client. There was a long stretch of silence as the three contemplated what to do next. Boyette grimaced and then began rubbing his slick head. He placed both palms on both temples and pressed as hard as possible, as if pressure from the outside world would relieve the pressure from within. "Are you having a seizure?" Keith asked, but there was no response. "He has these seizures," Keith said to Robbie, as if an explanation would help matters. "Caffeine helps." Robbie jumped to his feet and left the room. Outside his office, he told Aaron and Pryor, "The son of a bitch wants money." He walked to the kitchen, grabbed a pot of stale coffee, found two paper cups, and returned to his office. He poured a cup for Boyette, who was bent double at the waist, elbows on knees, cradling his head and moaning. "Here's some coffee." Silence. Finally, Boyette said,
"I'm gonna be sick. I need to lie down."
"Take the sofa," Robbie said, pointing to it across the room. Boyette struggled to his feet and, with Keith's help, made it to the sofa, where he wrapped his arms around his head and pulled his knees to his chest.
"Can you turn off the lights?" Boyette said. "I'll be okay in a minute."
"We don't have time for this," Robbie said, ready to scream.
"Please, just a minute,"
Boyette said pathetically as his body vibrated and he gasped for air. Keith and Robbie left the office and stepped into the conference room. A crowd soon gathered and Robbie introduced Keith to the rest of the gang. The food arrived, and they ate quickly. Chapter 21. They came for Dante at noon. Not a minute before, not a minute after. Everything precise and well rehearsed. There was a knock on the metal door behind him. Three loud raps. He was talking to Cedric, but when he knew it was time, he asked for his mother. Roberta was standing behind Cedric with Andrea and Marvin at her sides, all four squeezed into the small room, all four crying now with no effort to hold back the tears. They had watched the clock for 4 hours, and there was nothing left to say. Cedric exchanged places with Roberta, who took the phone and placed her palm on the plexiglass. Dante did the same from the other side. His three siblings embraced behind his mother, all four huddled together, touching, with Andrea in the middle and on the verge of collapse.
"I love you, Mama," Dante said, "and I'm so sorry this is happening." "I love you too, baby, and you don't have to say you're sorry. You did nothing wrong."
Dante wiped his cheeks with a sleeve.
"I always wished I could have gotten out of here before Daddy died. I wanted him to see me as a free man. I wanted him to know that I did nothing wrong." "He knew that, Dante. Your daddy never doubted you. When he died, he knew you were innocent."
She wiped her face with a tissue.
"I've never doubted you either, baby."
"I know. I guess I'll be seeing Daddy pretty soon."
Roberta nodded, but could not respond. The door behind him opened, and a large male guard appeared. Dante hung up the phone, stood, and placed both palms flat on the plexiglass. His family did the same. One final embrace, and then he was gone. With his hands cuffed again, Dante was led from the visitor's wing, through a series of clicking metal doors, out of the building, over a lawn crisscrossed with sidewalks, and into a wing where he was taken back to his cell for the last time. Everything now was for the last time. And as Dante sat on his bunk and stared at his box of assets, he almost convinced himself that it would be a relief to get away. His family was given a few minutes to collect themselves. As Ruth was leading them out of the room, she gave them a hug. She said she was sorry, and they thanked her for her kindness. Just as they were walking through a metal door, she said,
"You folks headed to Huntsville?"
"Yes, of course they were."
"Might want to get on over there. Rumor is there might be trouble on the roads."
They nodded, but were not sure how to respond. They walked through security at the front building, got their driver's licenses and purses, and walked out of Polunsky for the last time. The trouble on the roads mentioned by Ruth was a clandestine Facebook conspiracy inspired by two black students at Sam Houston State University in Huntsville. The code name was Detour, and the plan was so simple and so brilliant that it attracted dozens of volunteers. In 2000, soon after Dante arrived on death row, the inmates were moved from Huntsville to Polunsky. The inmates were moved. The death chamber was not. For 7 years and 200 executions, it had been necessary to haul the condemned men from Polunsky to Huntsville. Elaborate movements were planned and used, but after a few dozen transfers with no ambushes, no heroic efforts to rescue the condemned, without a hitch of any kind, the authorities realized that no one was watching. No one really cared. The elaborate plans were discarded, and the same route was used with every transfer. They left the prison at 1 p.m., turned left on 350, turned left again on 190, a four-lane road with plenty of traffic, and an hour later the trip was over. Inmates were placed in the rear of an unmarked passenger van, surrounded by enough muscle and weaponry to protect the president, and escorted, for good measure, by an identical van filled with another squad of bored guards hoping for a little excitement. The last execution had been on September 25th, when Michael Richard was injected. 10 students, all members of Operation Detour, used 5 vehicles and plenty of cell phones to track the movements of the 2 white vans from Polunsky to Huntsville. The students were not detected. No one suspected them. No one was looking for them. By early November, their plan was complete, and their operatives were itching for trouble. At 12:50 p.m., a guard, a black one, sympathetic to Dante, tipped off a member of Detour. The two white vans were being loaded. The transfer had begun. At 1 p.m., the vans left the prison for a service road near the maximum security unit. They turned onto Route 350 and headed for Livingston. There was little traffic. 2 miles from the prison, the traffic increased, became heavy, then stopped completely. Ahead of the vans, a car had stalled in the right lane. Oddly, one had stalled in the left lane, and another on the shoulder. The three cars blocked any passage. Their drivers were out checking under their hoods. Then, behind the three cars, there were three more, all stalled in a neat line across the road. The vans did not move and seemed to be in no hurry. Behind them, in the right lane, another car came to a stop. Its driver, a young black woman, popped the hood, got out, feigned exasperation because her Nissan had quit on her. A Volkswagen Beetle pulled beside her in the left lane, suffered a mechanical failure on cue, and the hood went up. More vehicles materialized from nowhere and bunched together behind the first wave, thoroughly blocking the road, its shoulders, and all exits and entrances to it. Within 5 minutes, a traffic jam of at least 20 vehicles had occurred. The white vans were surrounded by disabled cars and SUVs, all with their hoods up, the drivers loitering about, talking, laughing, chatting on cell phones. Several of the male students went from car to car, disabling each by pulling the wires to the distributor caps. The state and local police arrived in minutes, dozens of marked cars with sirens screaming. They were followed by a brigade of tow trucks, all of which had been rounded up in Livingston on short notice. Operation Detour had briefed its volunteers well. Each driver was adamant that his or her car had quit, and under Texas law, this was not a crime. Citations would certainly be written for blocking traffic, but Detour had found a lawyer who would fight those in court. Officers did not have the right to take keys and check the engines for themselves, and if they tried, the engines were dead. The students had been told to resist searches of their vehicles, to peacefully resist any attempts at being arrested, to threaten legal action in the face of an arrest, and if arrested, consider it an honor, a badge of courage in the fight against injustice. Detour had other lawyers who would handle their cases. The students relished the thought of being locked up, an act of defiance in their minds, something they could talk about for years. As the police cars and wreckers parked haphazardly near the traffic jam, and as the first troopers were approaching the students, the second phase of the plan fell beautifully into place. Another wave of students in cars turned onto Route 350 from Livingston and were soon approaching the melee. They parked three abreast and three deep behind the tow trucks. All hoods popped open, more roadside breakdowns. Since the tow truck drivers were expected to react with anger and maybe violence to being penned in, the second wave of drivers remained in their cars with the windows up and doors locked. Most cars were full of students, and many were healthy young men who could take care of themselves. They wouldn't mind a fight. They were angry to begin with. A tow truck driver approached the first car parked behind him, realized it was full of blacks, and began swearing and making threats. A state trooper yelled at him and told him to shut up. The trooper was Sergeant Inman, and he took charge of a truly unique situation, one that included, so far, 8 police cars, 7 tow trucks, at least 30 disabled vehicles, and 2 prison vans, one of which was transporting a man to his death. To make matters worse, the locals who routinely used Route 350 were backing up, unaware they had chosen the wrong time to get from one place to another. The road was hopelessly clogged. Inman was a cool professional, and he knew something the students didn't. As he walked through the jam headed for the vans, he nodded politely at the students, smiled, asked if they were having a nice day. At the vans, security details for Dante unloaded, thick men in blue SWAT-style uniforms with automatic weapons. Most of the students made their way close to the vans. One seemed to lead the pack. Inman approached him, extended a hand, and politely said, "I'm Sergeant Inman. May I ask your name?" "Quincy Mooney," He reluctantly shook Inman's hand. Mr. Mooney, I'm sorry about your car breaking down. Don't mention it. Inman looked around, smiled at the other students. All these folks friends of yours? I've never seen them before. Inman smiled. Look, Mr. Mooney, we need to get these cars off the road. Traffic's backing up, everything's blocked. Guess we need to call some mechanics. No, we're just gonna tow them, Quincy. Unless, of course, y'all would like to save $100 and drive away. If you chose to do so, then we wouldn't be forced to write a bunch of tickets. That's another $100 a car. So, it's against the law for your car to break down? No, sir, it's not. But you and I both know why you're here. The judge will know, too. I know why I'm here. Why are you here? I'm doing my job, Quincy. Traffic control and keeping the peace. Inman nodded his head and said, Come with me. Quincy followed him to the first van. Its double side doors were open. Inman looked inside, then invited Quincy to do the same. The van was empty. They walked to the second van. Both looked inside. It, too, was empty. The security guards were snickering. The whirling thump-thump of a helicopter could be heard. Where's Dante Drum? Quincy asked, stunned. He ain't here, is he? Inman asked with a smirk. Quincy stared at the darkened windows of the empty van. They walked back to the front of the first one. Inman looked to the sky, in the direction of Polensky. Everyone waited and waited, and seconds later a helicopter roared directly over them. Inman pointed at it and said, There goes Dante. Quincy's jaw dropped, his shoulders slumped. Words spread through the students, and there were looks of shock and disbelief. A perfect operation had been compromised. Dante Drum would arrive at the death chamber ahead of schedule. Too much internet chatter, Inman said. Here's the deal, Quincy. You guys have 15 minutes to clear this road and get out of here. In 15 minutes, we start writing tickets and towing. And just so you know, there won't be any arrests, so don't provoke us. Got it? Quincy walked away, thoroughly defeated. Boyette, after a sandwich and three cups of coffee, was feeling better. He was at the table, lights on, shades opened. Robbie and Keith were staring at him, and no one was smiling. Evidently, the issue of money had been put aside by Boyette, at least for the moment. So, if I tell you what happened with Nicole, what happens to me? He asked, looking at Robbie. Nothing. At least, nothing for a long time. The cops and prosecutors have their man. If he's killed tonight, then they'll never consider pursuing someone else. If Dante gets a stay, I'm not sure what they'll do, but it'll be a long time before they admit that anybody but Dante killed Nicole. They have far too much invested in their wrongful conviction. So I won't be arrested today or tomorrow or the next day. I can't speak for these clowns, Mr. Boyette. I don't know what they'll do. As a general rule, the cops here are stupid, and Detective Kerber is a moron. But to arrest you is to admit they were wrong about Dante, and that's not going to happen. If you walked into the police station right now, swore on a Bible, and gave them every detail of the abduction, rape, and murder, they would dismiss you outright as a lunatic. They'll have no desire to believe you, Mr. Boyette. Your admission destroys them. The tick. The pause. Robbie leaned forward and glared at him. Time's up, Mr. Boyette. I want to hear it. Tell me the truth. Did you kill the girl? Yes. Just like I told Keith here. I grabbed her, raped her for 2 days, then choked her and hid the body. Where is the body? Finding the body will stop the execution, I guarantee it. Where is it? In the hills south of Joplin, Missouri. Deep in the hills. Joplin, Missouri is at least 5 hours from here.
More than that, Nicole and I drove there.
So she was alive when you left Texas.
The tick. The pause. Finally. Yes. I killed her in Missouri. Raped her from here to there.
Is it possible to call the authorities in Joplin and tell them how to find the body?
Boyette managed to laugh at such foolishness. You think I'm stupid? Why would I bury her where someone could find her? I'm not even sure I can find her after all these years.
Robbie anticipated this and didn't miss a beat. Then we need to take your statement by video and quickly.
Okay, I'm ready.
They walked to the conference room where Carlos was waiting with a camera and a court reporter. Boyette was directed to a chair facing the camera. The court reporter sat to his right, Robbie to his left. Carlos worked the camera. The other members of the firm suddenly materialized. Robbie wanted them as witnesses, and they stood with Keith 10 feet away. Boyette looked at them and was suddenly nervous. He felt like a man facing his own well-attended execution. The court reporter asked him to raise his right hand and swear to tell the truth. He did, and then Robbie began the questioning. Name, place of birth, address, employment, current status as a parolee, and criminal record. He asked if Boyette was giving his statement voluntarily. Nothing had been promised. Was he living in Sloan in December 1998? Why? How long? Robbie's questions were gentle but efficient. Boyette looked squarely at the camera, no flinching or blinking, and seemed to warm to the task. Oddly, the tick went away. Tell us about Nicole. Boyette thought for a second and then launched into his narrative. The football games, the fascination with Nicole, the obsession, the stalking, and finally the abduction outside the mall, not a single witness anywhere. On the floor of his truck, he put a gun to her head and threatened to kill her if she made a sound. Then he bound her wrists and ankles with duct tape. He taped her mouth. He drove somewhere into the country, he was not sure where, and after he raped her the first time, he almost dumped her in a ditch, injured but not dead, but wanted to rape her again. They left Sloan. The cell phone in her handbag kept ringing and ringing, so he finally stopped at a bridge over the Red River. He took her cash, credit card, and driver's license, then threw the handbag off the bridge. They drifted through southeastern Oklahoma. Just before sunrise near Fort Smith, he saw a cheap motel he'd stayed in before, alone. He paid cash for a room and, with a gun to her head, got her inside without being seen. He taped her wrists, ankles, and mouth again and told her to go to sleep. He slept a few hours, not sure if she did. They spent a long day at the motel. He convinced her that if she would cooperate, give him what he wanted, then he would release her. But he already knew the truth. After dark, they moved on, headed north. At daybreak on Sunday, they were south of Joplin in a heavily wooded, remote area. She begged him, but he killed her anyway. It wasn't easy. She fought hard, scratched him, drew blood. He stuffed her body in a large toolbox and buried it. No one would ever find her. He drove back to Sloan and got drunk. Robbie was taking notes. The court reporter pressed the keys of her stenotype machine. No one else moved. No one seemed to breathe. Boyette went silent, his story complete. His detached narration and his command of details were chilling. Martha Handler would later write, "Watching Boyette's eyes and face as he talked about his crimes left no doubt that we were in the presence of a ruthless killer. The story that we will never know, and perhaps prefer not to know, is the suffering this poor girl endured throughout the ordeal." Robbie, calm but also anxious to finish the testimony, pressed on. "Approximately what time on Sunday did you kill her?"
"The sun was barely up. I waited until I could see things, see where I was, and find the best place to hide her. And this was Sunday, December 6th, 1998. If you say so, yes. So sunrise would be around 6:30 a.m.? That sounds about right. And you returned to Sloan and went where? I went to my room at the Rebel Motor Inn after I'd bought a case of beer with the cash I took from Nicole. You got drunk at the Rebel Motor Inn? Yes. How long did you live in Sloan after the murder? I don't know, maybe a month and a half. I was arrested here in January. You got the records. After I got out of jail, I took off. After you killed her, when did you hear that Dante Drum had been arrested? Don't know exactly. Saw it on television. I saw you yelling at the cameras. What did you think when he was arrested? Boyette shook his head and said, I thought, what a bunch of idiots. That kid had nothing to do with it. They got the wrong guy. It was a perfect place to end. Robbie said, that's all. Carlos reached for the camera. Robbie asked the court reporter, how long before we have a transcript? 10 minutes. Good, hurry. Robbie huddled with the rest of his firm at the conference table and everyone talked at once. Boyette was forgotten for a moment, though Fred Pryor kept an eye on him. Boyette asked for water and Pryor handed him a bottle. Keith stepped outside to call Dana and Matthew Burns and to get some fresh air. But the air wasn't refreshing. It was heavy with smoke and tension. There was a loud thud, followed by a shriek as Boyette fell out of his chair and hit the floor. He grabbed his head, pulled his knees to his chest, and began shaking as the seizure consumed him. Fred Pryor and Aaron Ray knelt over him, uncertain what to do. Robbie and the others crowded around, staring in horror at a fit so violent that the ancient wooden floor seemed to shake. They actually felt sorry for the man. Keith heard the commotion and joined the crowd. He needs a doctor, Sammy Thomas said. He has meds, doesn't he, Keith? Robbie asked in a hushed tone. Yes. Have you seen this before? Boyette was still thrashing about, groaning pitifully. Surely the man was dying. Fred Pryor was patting him softly on the arm. Yes, Keith said, about 4 hours ago somewhere in Oklahoma. He vomited forever and then passed out. Should we take him to the hospital? I mean, look, Keith, could he be dying right now? I don't know, I'm not a doctor. What else do you need from him? We must have his signature on his affidavit signed under oath. Robbie stepped back and motioned for Keith to join him. They spoke softly. Robbie continued. And then there's the matter of finding the body. Even with his affidavit, there's no guarantee the court will stop the execution. The governor will not. Either way, we have to find the body and soon. Keith said, let's put him on the sofa in your office, turn off the lights, I'll give him a pill. Maybe he's not dying. Good idea. It was 1:20 p.m. Chapter 22. Dante's first helicopter ride was intended to be his last. Courtesy of the Texas Department of Public Safety, he was moving through the air at 90 miles per hour, 3,000 feet above the rolling hills, and he could see nothing below. He was wedged between two guards, thick young men scowling out the windows as if Operation Detour might have a surface-to-air missile or two in its arsenal. Up front were the two pilots, grim-faced boys thrilled with the excitement of their mission. The rocky, noisy ride made Dante nauseous, so he closed his eyes, leaned his head back against hard plastic, and tried to think of something pleasant. He could not. He practiced his last statement, mouthing the words, though with the racket in the helicopter he could have barked them out and no one would have noticed. He thought of other inmates, some friends, some enemies, almost all guilty, but a few who claimed innocence, and how they faced their deaths. The ride lasted 20 minutes, and when the helicopter landed at the old rodeo grounds inside Huntsville Prison,
a small army awaited the prisoner. Dante, laden with chains and shackles, was practically carried by his guards to a van. Minutes later, the van pulled into an alley lined with chain-link fencing covered by a thick windscreen and topped with glistening razor wire. Dante was escorted from the van, through a gate, along a short sidewalk to a small, flat, red-brick building where Texas does its killing. Inside, he squinted and tried to focus on his new surroundings. There were 8 cells to his right, each emptying onto a short hallway. On a table, there were several Bibles, including one in Spanish. A dozen guards milled about, some chatting about the weather as if the weather were important at that moment. Dante was positioned in front of a camera and photographed. The handcuffs were removed, and a technician informed him they would now fingerprint him.
"Why?"
Dante asked.
"Routine," came the response.
He took a finger and rolled it on the ink pad.
"I don't understand why you need to fingerprint a man before you kill him."
The technician did not respond.
"I get it," Dante said. "You want to make sure you got the right man, right?"
The technician rolled another finger.
"Well, you got the wrong man this time. I can assure you of that."
When the fingerprinting was over, he was led to the holding cell, 1 of 8. The other 7 were not used. Dante sat on the edge of the bunk. He noticed how shiny the floors were, how clean the sheets were, how pleasant the temperature. On the other side of the bars in the hallway were several prison officials. One stepped to the bars and said,
"Dante, I'm Ben Jeter, the warden here at Huntsville."
Dante nodded but did not stand. He stared at the floor.
"Our chaplain is Tommy Powell. He's here, and he'll stay here all afternoon."
Without looking up, Dante said,
"Don't need a chaplain."
"It's your call. Now listen to me, because I want to tell you how things happen around here."
"I think I know what happens."
"Well, I'll tell you anyway."
After a round of speeches, each more strident than the one before, the rally lost some steam. A large mob of blacks packed around the front of the courthouse and even spilled onto Main Street, which had been closed. When no one else took up the bullhorn, the drum corps came to life, and the crowd followed the music down Main Street, heading west, chanting, waving banners, singing, "We Shall Overcome." Trey Glover assumed his role as parade master and maneuvered his SUV in front of the drummers. The rap blasted the downtown shops and cafes where the owners, clerks, and customers stood in the windows and doors. Why were the blacks so upset? The boy confessed. He killed Nicole. He said he did it. An eye for an eye. There was no trouble, but the town seemed ready to erupt. When Trey and the drummers came to Sisk Avenue, they turned right, not left. A left turn would have routed the march to the south, the general direction of where it started. A turn to the right meant they were headed into the white section. Still, no one had thrown anything, no threats had been made. A few police cars followed well behind, while others shadowed the march from parallel streets. 2 blocks north of Main, and they were in the older residential section. The noise brought people to their porches, and what they saw sent them back inside to their gun cabinets. They also went to their phones to call the mayor and the police chief. Surely this was disturbing the peace. What are these folks so upset about? The boy confessed. Do something. Civitan Park was a complex of youth baseball and softball fields on Sisk, 5 blocks north of Main, and Trey Glover decided they had walked far enough. The drums were put aside and the march came to an end. It was now a gathering, a volatile mix of youth, anger, and a sense of having nothing better to do for the afternoon and evening. A police captain estimated the crowd at 1,200. Almost all under the age of 30. Most of the older blacks had fallen aside and returned home. Cell phones confirmed details, and cars full of more young blacks headed for Civitan Park. Across town, another crowd of angry blacks watched as the fire crews saved what was left of the Mount Sinai Church of God in Christ. Because of the quick 911 call and the quick response, the damage was not as extensive as that inflicted on the First Baptist Church, but the sanctuary was fairly gutted. The flames had been extinguished, but the smoke still poured from the windows. With no wind, it too lingered over the town and added another layer of tension. Reva's departure for Huntsville was properly recorded. She invited some family and friends over for another gut-wrenching performance, and everybody had a good cry for the cameras. Sean Fordyce was on a jet at that moment, zipping in from Florida, and they would hook up in Huntsville for the pre-execution interview. With Wallace, her other two children, and brother Ronnie, there were five in her party, and for a three-hour drive that might be uncomfortable. So Reva had prevailed upon her pastor to borrow one of the church vans, and even suggested that he do the driving. Brother Ronnie was exhausted and emotionally spent as well, but he was in no position to argue with Reva, not at that moment, not on the most important day of her life. They loaded up and pulled away, Brother Ronnie behind the wheel of a 10-passenger van with First Baptist Church of Sloan, Texas, painted boldly on both sides. Everyone waved at the friends and well-wishers. Everyone waved at the camera. Reva was crying before they reached the outskirts of town. After 15 minutes in the quiet darkness of Robbie's office, Boyette rallied. He stayed on the sofa, his mind numb from pain, his feet and hands still wobbly. When Keith peeked through the door, Boyette said,
"I'm here, Pastor. Still alive."
Keith walked closer and asked, "How you doing, Travis?"
"Much better, Pastor."
"Can I get something for you?"
"Some coffee. Seems to help ease the pain."
Keith left and closed the door. He found Robbie and reported that Boyette was still alive. At the moment, the court reporter was transcribing Boyette's statement. Sammy Thomas and both paralegals, Carlos and Bonnie, were frantically putting together a filing that was already known as the Boyette Petition. Judge Elias Henry walked into the office, past the receptionist, and into the conference room. "Over here," Robbie said, and led the judge into a small library. He closed the door, picked up a remote, and said, "You gotta see this."
"What is it?"
Judge Henry asked as he fell into a chair. "Just wait." He pointed the remote at a screen on a wall, and Boyette appeared. "This is the man who killed Nicole Yarber. We just taped this." The video ran for 14 minutes. They watched it without a word.
"Where is he?"
Judge Henry asked when the screen went dark. "In my office on the sofa. He has a malignant brain tumor, or so he says, and he's dying. He walked into the office of a Lutheran minister in Topeka, Kansas, Monday morning and spilled his guts. He played some games, but the minister finally got him in a car. They arrived in Sloan a couple hours ago."
"The minister drove him here?"
"Yep. Hang on." Robbie opened the door and called Keith over. He introduced him to Judge Henry.
"This is the man," Robbie said, patting Keith on the back. "Have a seat. Judge Henry's our circuit court judge. If he had presided over the trial of Dante Drum, we wouldn't be here right now."
"Pleasure to meet you," Keith said.
"Sounds like you're having quite an adventure."
Keith laughed and said, "I don't know where I am or what I'm doing."
"Then you've come to the right law firm," Judge Henry said.
They shared a laugh, a quick one, and then all humor vanished. "What do you think?" Robbie asked Judge Henry. The judge scratched his cheek, thought hard for a moment, and then said,
"Question is, what will the Court of Appeals think? You can never tell. They hate these last-minute surprise witnesses who pop up and begin changing facts that are 10 years old. Plus, a man who's made a career out of aggravated rape is not likely to be taken seriously. I'd give you a slight chance of getting a stay."
"That's a lot more than we had 2 hours ago," Robbie said.
"When do you file? It's almost 2 o'clock.
"Within the hour. Here's my question.
Do we tell the press about Mr. Boyette? I'm sending the video to the court and to the governor. I can also give it to the local TV station. Or I can send it to every station in Texas. Or, better yet, I can arrange a press conference here or at the courthouse and let the world listen as Boyette tells his story.
To what benefit?
Maybe I want the world to know that Texas is about to execute the wrong man. Here's the killer. Listen to him.
But the world cannot stop the execution. Only the courts or the governor can do that. I'd be careful here, Robbie. There's smoke in the air now, and if people see Boyette on television claiming responsibility, this place could blow up.
It's blowing up anyway.
You want a race war?
If they kill Dante, yes, I wouldn't mind a race war. A small one.
Come on, Robbie. You're playing with dynamite here. Think strategically, not emotionally. And keep in mind that this guy could be lying. This would not be the first execution where a fraud claimed responsibility. The press can't resist it. A nut gets on television. Everybody looks stupid.
Robbie was pacing, four steps one way, four steps the other. He was fidgety, frantic, but still thinking clearly. He had great admiration for Judge Henry, and Robbie was smart enough to know he needed advice at that moment. The room was quiet. On the other side of the door, the voices were tense. The phones were ringing. Judge Henry said,
"I assume it's possible to search for the body."
Robbie shook his head and deferred to Keith, who said, "Not now. 2 days ago, Tuesday I think it was, I'm not sure, I feel as though I've lived with this guy for a year. But anyway, Tuesday I suggested the best way to stop the execution was to find the body. He said that it would be difficult. He buried her 9 years ago in a secluded area that is heavily wooded. He also said that he's gone back to visit her several times. I'm not sure what that meant, and I really didn't want to pursue it. Then I lost contact with him. I searched and searched, and I was determined to somehow corral him and insist that we notify the authorities, here and in Missouri, if that is, in fact, where Nicole is buried. But he would not agree. Then we lost contact again. He's a strange guy, very strange. He called me around midnight last night. I was already in bed, sound asleep, and he said he wanted to come here to tell his story to stop the execution. I felt as though I had no choice. I've never done anything like this before, I can promise you that. I know it's wrong to help a convict violate his parole, but so be it. Anyway, we left Topeka around 1 this morning, and again I suggested that we notify the authorities and at least begin the search for the body. He wanted no part of that.
It would not have worked, Keith, Robbie said. The authorities here are useless. They would laugh at you. They have their man. The case is solved. Almost closed, I guess. Nobody in Missouri would lift a finger because there's no active investigation. You can't just call a sheriff and suggest that he and his boys go out in the woods and start digging somewhere down by the creek. Doesn't work that way.
Then who looks for the body? Keith asked.
I guess we do.
I'm going home, Robbie. My wife is barking at me. My lawyer friend thinks I'm crazy. I think I'm crazy. I've done my best. Boyette's all yours. I'm sick of the guy.
Relax, Keith. I need you right now.
For what?
Just hang around, okay? Boyette trusts you. Besides, when was the last time you had front row seats at a race riot?
Not funny.
Sit on the video, Robbie, Judge Henry said. Show it to the court and to the governor, but don't make it public.
I can control the video, but I cannot control Mr. Boyette. If he wants to talk to the press, I can't stop him. God knows he's not my client.
By 2:30 Thursday afternoon, every church in Sloan, black and white, was being guarded by preachers, deacons, and Sunday school teachers. All men, all heavily armed and visible. They sat on the front steps and chatted anxiously, shotguns across their knees. They sat under shade trees near the streets, waving at the passing cars, many of which honked in solidarity. They patrolled the rear doors and back property, smoking, chewing, watching for any movement. There would be no more church burnings in Sloan. The cotton gin had been abandoned 2 decades earlier when a newer one replaced it east of town. It was an eyesore, a badly decaying old building, and under normal circumstances a good fire would have been welcomed. The 911 call was recorded at 2:44. A teenager driving by saw heavy smoke and called on her cell phone. The beleaguered firemen rushed to the old gin mill, and by the time they arrived, the flames were roaring through the roof. Since it was an empty, abandoned building, and not a great loss anyway, they took their time. The black smoke boiled into the sky. The mayor could see it from his second-story office near the courthouse, and after consulting with the chief of police, he called the governor's office. The situation in Sloan was not likely to improve. The citizens were in danger. They needed the National Guard. Chapter 23. The petition was finished just before 3 p.m., and with Boyette's affidavit included, it ran for 30 pages. Boyette swore in writing that he was telling the truth, and Sammy Thomas emailed the petition to the Defender Group's office in Austin. The staff there was waiting. It was printed, copied 12 times, and handed off to Cicely Avis, who sprinted from the office, hopped in her car, and raced across town to the offices of the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. The petition was filed at 3:35. "What's this?" the clerk asked, holding a disc. "It's a video of a confession by the real murderer," Cicely replied. "Interesting. I assume you want the judges to see this fairly soon."
"Right now, please."
"I'll get it done." They chatted for a second and Cicely left the office. The clerk immediately delivered the petition to the offices of the 9 judges. In the Chief Justice's office, he spoke to the law clerk and said, "You might want to watch the video first. Some guy just confessed to the murder." "And where is this guy?" asked the clerk. "He's in Dante Drum's lawyer's office in Sloan, according to the Defender Group lawyer." "So Robbie Flax found him a new witness."
"Looks like it."
As Cicely Avis left the TCCA offices, she detoured 2 blocks and drove past the state capitol. The rally for Dante was drawing a nice crowd on the south lawn. Police were everywhere. A permit had been issued, and the First Amendment appeared to be working. The crowd, almost all black, was streaming in. The permit was valid for 3 hours, from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m., the moment of execution. But it was obvious things were behind schedule. In Austin, but certainly not in Huntsville. The governor was in a meeting, an important one, one that had nothing to do with Dante Drum. At 3:11, the video was received by an assistant who handled the requests for reprieves, and she watched all 14 minutes of it before she could decide what to do next. While she found Boyette somewhat believable and chilling, she was skeptical because of his background and the timing of his sudden desire to come clean. She went to find Wayne Walcott, the governor's lawyer and close friend, and described the video. Walcott listened closely, then shut the door of his office and told her to sit down.
"Who has seen this video?" he asked.
"Only me," the assistant answered. "It was emailed from Mr. Flack's office with a passcode. I watched it immediately, and here I am."
"And it's a full confession?"
"Oh, yes, with lots of details."
"And you believe this guy?"
"I didn't say that. I said he seems to know what he's talking about. He's a serial rapist, and he was in Sloan when the girl disappeared. It's a full confession."
"Does he mention Drum?"
"Why don't you just watch the video?"
"I didn't ask for any suggestions, did I?" Walcott snapped. "Just answer my questions."
"Sorry."
The assistant took a breath. She was suddenly nervous and uneasy. Walcott was listening, but he was also scheming.
"He mentioned Drum only to say that he's never met him and he had nothing to do with the crime."
"He's obviously lying. I'm not bothering the governor with this, and I want you to keep the video to yourself. I don't have the time to look at it. Neither does the governor, you understand?
She did not, but she nodded anyway. Walcott narrowed his eyes and frowned.
You do understand, don't you? He asked gravely. This video stays in your computer.
Yes, sir.
As soon as she left, Walcott practically jogged to the office of Barry Ringfield, the governor's chief spokesman and closest friend. The office suite was crawling with staff and interns, so they took a stroll down the hall. After a few minutes of discussing their options, they agreed that the governor would not see the video. If Boyette was lying, then the video would be irrelevant and the right man was executed. But if Boyette was telling the truth, which they strongly doubted, and the wrong man was executed, the fallout could be messy. The only way to protect Governor Gil Newton was for one of them, or perhaps the assistant, to take the fall by admitting they sat on, or maybe even lost, the video. Gil Newton had never granted a reprieve in a death case, and with the thrilling attention being stirred up by the drum case, he was not about to back down now. Even if he watched the video, and even if he believed Boyette, he would not retreat. Wayne and Barry walked to the governor's office. They were expected there promptly at 4 p.m., 2 hours before the execution, and they would not tell the governor about the video. At 3:30 p.m., the Flack law firm gathered once again around the main conference table. All were present and accounted for, including Keith, who, though fighting the worst fatigue of his life, was finding it hard to believe he had somehow acquired a ticket to this circus. He and Judge Henry sat away from the table against a wall. Aaron Ray and Fred Pryor read newspapers on the other side of the room. Travis Boyette was still alive, still resting in the dark on Robbie's sofa. It was past time for Robbie to leave for Huntsville, and the strain was showing, but he couldn't leave yet. The Boyette petition had energized the team and given them hope. Robbie worked from a checklist. Yellow legal pad, as always. Sammy Thomas and Bonnie would track the Boyette petition before the Court of Appeals and also continue to press the governor's office on the reprieve. Gil Newton had yet to grant or deny, and he usually waited until the last moment. He loved the drama and attention. Carlos would track the insanity petition, which was still with the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. If denied there, they would appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. Fred Pryor would remain at the office and tend to Boyette. No one knew what to do with Boyette, but he didn't appear to be leaving. As always, Aaron Ray would accompany Robbie to Huntsville. Martha Handler would also go to observe and record. Robbie barked orders, answered questions, refereed conflicts, and then suddenly looked at the Reverend and asked, "Keith, can you go with us to Huntsville?" For a few seconds, the Reverend couldn't speak. "Why, Robbie?" he managed to ask. "Dante might need you." Keith's mouth fell open and no words came out. The room was quiet, all eyes on Keith. Robbie pressed on. "He was raised in a church, Keith, but he now takes a dim view of religion. His jury had 5 Baptists, 2 Pentecostals, 1 Church of Christ, and I guess the others were lost. Over the past few years, he's come to believe that white Christians are the reason he's on death row. He wants no part of their God, and I don't expect him to change his views anytime soon. Still, at the very end, he might appreciate someone to pray with." What Keith wanted was a nice bed in a clean motel and 12 hours of sleep. But, as a man of God, he couldn't say no. He nodded slowly and said, "Sure. Good. We'll leave in 5 minutes. Keith closed his eyes and rubbed his temples and said to himself, "Lord, what am I doing here? Help me." Fred Pryor suddenly jumped from his chair. He held his cell phone at arm's length as if it were white hot and said loudly, "Oh boy, it's Joey Gamble. He wants to sign an affidavit and recant his testimony." "Is he on the phone?" Robbie said. "No, it's a text message. Should I call him?" "Of course," Robbie snapped. Pryor stepped to the center of the table and pressed the keys on the speakerphone. No one moved as the phone rang and rang. Finally, a timid, "Hello?"
"Joey, Fred Pryor here in Sloan.
Just got your message. What the hell's going on? I want to help, Mr. Pryor. I'm really upset by all this.
You think you're upset? What about Dante? He's got 2.5 hours to live, and now you finally wake up and want to help?
I'm so confused, Joey said.
Robbie leaned forward and took charge.
Joey, this is Robbie Flack, remember?
Of course.
Where are you?
Mission Bend in my apartment.
Are you willing to sign an affidavit admitting that you lied at Dante's trial?
With no hesitation, Joey said,
yes.
Robbie closed his eyes and dropped his head. Around the table, there were silent fist pumps, quick prayers of thanks, and a lot of tired smiles.
All right, here's the plan. There's a lawyer in Houston by the name of Agnes Tanner. Her office is downtown on Clay Street. Do you know the city?
I guess.
Can you find an office downtown?
I don't know. I'm not sure I should drive.
Are you drunk?
Not drunk, but I've been drinking.
Robbie instinctively glanced at his watch. Not yet 4 p.m. and the boy was already thick-tongued.
Joey, call a cab. I'll reimburse you later. It's crucial that you get to Tanner's office as quickly as possible. We'll email an affidavit, you sign it, and we'll get it filed in Austin. Can you do this, Joey?
I'll try.
It's the least you can do, Joey. Right now, Dante's in the holding cell in Huntsville, 30 feet from the little room where they kill people. And your lies helped put him there.
I'm so sorry. His voice cracked.
The office is at 118 Clay Street. You got that, Joey?
I think so.
Get there, Joey. The paperwork will be waiting for you. Every minute is crucial, Joey. Do you understand?
Okay, okay.
Call us back in 10 minutes.
You got it.
After the call ended, Robbie barked orders and everyone scrambled. As he headed for the door, he said,
"Let's go, Keith."
They jumped in the van, with Martha Handler racing to keep up with them, and Aaron Ray sped away. Robbie called Agnes Tanner in Houston and urgently confirmed the details. Keith leaned forward and looked at Aaron in the rearview mirror.
"Someone said it's a 3-hour drive to Huntsville?"
"It is," Aaron replied. "But we're not driving."
The Sloan Municipal Airport was 2 miles east of town. It had one runway, west to east, 4 small hangars, the usual collection of old Cessnas in a row on the deck, and a square metal building for the terminal. They parked, ran through the tiny lobby area, nodded at a deckhand behind the desk, and stepped onto the tarmac where a shiny twin-engine King Air was waiting. It was owned by a wealthy lawyer friend of Robbie's who was an avid pilot. He got them on board, locked the door, made them fasten their seat belts, then strapped himself in and began flipping switches. Keith had not talked to his wife in several hours, and things were happening so fast he wasn't sure where to begin. Dana answered during the first beep, as if she'd been staring at her cell phone. The engine started, and the cabin was suddenly loud and shaking.
"Where are you?" she asked.
"In an airplane leaving Sloan, flying to Huntsville to meet Dante Drum."
"I can barely hear you. Whose airplane?"
"A friend of Robbie Flack's. Look, Dana, I can't hear you either. I'll call you when we land in Huntsville."
"Please be careful, Keith."
"Love you."
Keith was facing the front of the plane, his knees almost touching Martha Handler's. He watched the pilot run through the checklist as they taxied away to the runway. Robbie, Martha, and Aaron were all on the phone, and Keith wondered how they could carry on a conversation amid the racket. At the end of the runway, the King Air did a 180 and pointed west. The pilot revved the engines, the plane shook harder and harder as if it might explode, then the pilot yelled,
"Hold on!"
and released the brakes. They jerked forward, and all 4 passengers closed their eyes. Within seconds, they were in the air. The landing gear folded with a thud, but Keith had no idea what he was hearing. In the blur of the moment, he realized that he had never before flown in a small airplane. Nor had he ever been to Texas, chauffeured a serial rapist and murderer, listened to his chilling confession, witnessed the chaos of a law firm trying to save an innocent man,
gone 4 days with virtually no sleep, picked up a speeding ticket in Oklahoma, or said yes to an invitation to pray with a man minutes before his death. They flew over Sloan at 2,000 feet and climbing. The old cotton gin was still burning, thick smoke boiling into a cloud. Keith closed his eyes again and tried to convince himself that he was where he was and doing what he was doing. He was not convinced. He prayed and asked God to take his hand and guide him now, because he had no idea what to do. He thanked God for his rather unusual situation, and acknowledged that only divine intervention could be responsible for it. At 5,000 feet, his chin hit his chest, the fatigue finally taking its toll. The bourbon was usually Knob Creek, but on special occasions, the really fine stuff was pulled out of the drawer. A shot each of Pappy Van Winkle's, and all three smacked their lips. They were starting a bit early, but the governor said he needed a stiff one. Barry and Wayne had never said no. They had their coats off, sleeves rolled up, ties loosened, busy men with a lot on their minds. They stood near a credenza in a corner, sipping, watching the rally on a small television. If they had opened a window, they could have heard the noise. One long-winded speaker after another delivered scathing attacks on the death penalty, racism, and the Texas judicial system. The term judicial lynching was used freely. So far, every speaker had demanded that the governor stop the execution. Capitol Security estimated the crowd at 10,000. Behind the governor's back, Barry and Wayne exchanged nervous glances. If the crowd could see the video, a riot would break out. Should they tell him? No. Maybe later. "Gil, we need to make a decision about the National Guard," Barry said. "What's happening in Sloan?" "As of 30 minutes ago, they burned 2 churches, one white and one black. Now an abandoned building is on fire. They canceled classes this morning at the high school after fights broke out. The blacks are marching and roaming the streets looking for trouble. One brick was thrown through the rear window of a police car, but so far there's been no other violence.